are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, August 14th, 2019. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, California counties the first to sue the Trump administration on their new public charge rules. Other states and counties lining up to do so. Meanwhile, the Epstein guards slept through their bed checks, falsified records, and someone posted his death on 4chan before anyone else knew. Meanwhile, Bill Barr attacks criminal justice reform prosecutors and unshackles the unshackled on police brutality. The Chinese military amasses on the border and denies entry of two U.S. warships into the Bay of Hong Kong, or the harbor of Hong Kong, as protests continue. Trump launches a direct assault on immigration judges. And a new book alleges the Kochs funded the Third Way to push trade on Democrats. And I imagine a lot of other its policies. Trump punts on some China tariffs as the economy starts to wobble. Stacey Abrams launches a group to fight voter suppression, eschews a presidential campaign, but open to vice presidential. And the EPA advises Newark residents to stop drinking their lead-tainted water. All this and more on today's program. Welcome, folks, to the show. Michael is back. You all remember him, Michael Brooks. What is it? Is that an Adidas outfit that you're wearing or no?
Well, the jacket is from Adidas, okay. And the shirt is not.
Right. I understand.
But actually, I need to. My friend Justin sent me a whole box of these from this company in L.A., so I'll get you the name of this t-shirt company soon.
Great. Sounds great.
It is. I want to obviously fast track that.
No, I'm sure that is going to be promoted.
Indeed.
Jamie is here, obviously, and Brendan is here as well. Matt is out for the day. We've got a bunch of stuff to cover. The administrative assault on our government continues by the Trump administration. We'll go over a couple of those things that we had mentioned in headlines over the past couple of days. Want to go a little bit further in depth into the new public charge laws. But, you know, I want to talk about this first because I was on the Hear the Burn podcast a couple of weeks ago and was talking about the press, in general, and but specifically in terms of the coverage of Bernie Sanders. And we don't go through this too much on this program because I think there's broadly a fairly sophisticated. If you've made your way to this program, you already have a fairly jaded perspective, I think, of the corporate news. And if you've been listening to this program, you know, since its inception on Air America, then you certainly do. And it's warranted. We never dug up the name of that reporter from Politico, Michael, who called, and I tell this story now almost weekly, it feels like, of when a Politico reporter called in the spring of 2015, because he was doing a story on Martin O'Malley. And the way he said it to me, Martin O'Malley wants to know how he can get progressive support away from Elizabeth Warren. And I was like, Elizabeth Warren, she's not running. He's got to worry about Bernie Sanders. And the guy just laughed, literally laughed. And I'm like, I'm being I'm being serious. Let me just double check that name. Let me double check that name.
But
I mean, and it's largely irrelevant who the guy specifically was, because this is the mentality that the largely hashtag not all reporters and journalists have towards Bernie Sanders, and more broadly toward the left, but also I think there's a specific quality that they have a problem with. Because when I think back to the Dean campaign, Howard Dean, he was perceived in many respects as the leftist, the most left of that 2004 primary field. But I'm not quite sure that that's an accurate assessment of his politics. And he was governor of Vermont. He was a fairly conservative, I don't want to say conservative, but within the in the context of the Democratic Party, a conservative when it came to many issues in Vermont, but he happened to be anti-war. But the other element of the Dean campaign was that he was one of the first candidates to harness what was at that time a nascent online presence. We didn't have social media nearly in the way. I don't even think we had the term social media per se, except for in academic circles at this point. You know, MySpace may have been around, but I don't think people perceived it that way. Facebook wasn't particularly ubiquitous. But there was a lot of internet-based organizing, and there was a lot of small donors. In fact, that was one of the first, as far as I can tell, real big small donor campaigns that used the internet. In fact, it was probably the first of the big that used the internet. And there was a resent by the press to the inclusion of a lot of newbies, essentially, and a lot of activists who did not have the pedigree that they had. And by the pedigree, I don't even necessarily mean education or aristocratic background. It really is just sort of like there was a lot of resent towards people who were smart and dedicated and excited.
Oh, I remember my friend's mom had some kind of chocolate dessert party for Howard Dean.
Right. I mean, there was, but beyond that, I'm talking specifically about the people that they had to bump up against. People who were challenging their particular story and narrative that they wanted to tell about politics.
And was that primarily Iraq as the fulcrum at that point?
Well, I mean, it was Iraq, but it was broader. It was a much broader palette of things. I mean,
just partisanship?
That's what brought. Well, just the whole notion of politics. Understand, with the blogs was the first time that people in the media had their voices questioned in any fashion whatsoever. Because for years they had the ability to go on cable television and they can't hear people yelling at the TV and other people can't hear individuals yelling at the TV. They had the ability to write stuff, and the only way to rebut what a reporter would write at that point, and remember, the left had no mass media. Air America was the first even vague taste of criticism that these media reporters got from the left that was in any way organized. And then all of a sudden these blogs show up and people get really offended. Hey, wait a second, you're questioning my, and they're getting embarrassed and they don't like it. And they don't like it. And there is still remains, although to a certain extent it's diminished without a doubt, this divide. And there is a resent of Bernie, not just, I think, because of his politics, although I think there's probably a connection between his politics and the sort of the nature of the political movement around him that irks them. And certainly in 2016, there was a lot of Bernie Sanders supporters who could be obnoxious online and who were difficult. That comes with the territory. We're all adults here, right? And
was there a candidate who didn't have some difficult supporters?
Well, I mean, Martin O'Malley. And so, anyways, the the point is that there is already this sort of low grade hostility. And look, let's be honest. You can look at the reporters and see where, you know, why, who's get where the hostility comes from. There is a class element to this, and there is a insider outsider element to this. And there's a lot of overlap in those groups, but so here is a story from Brian Williams on the 11th hour. And there's two aspects of this. It's coming out of, let's play the clips of Bernie Sanders talking about Amazon and Washington Post, because Bernie Sanders has been talking about the coverage and the nature of the questions that he's getting, which are all, and we saw this during the debates, and he wasn't certainly the only person who made this complaint during the debates. He just did it in a way that gets more attention, maybe. But we saw this in the debates, which is that the framing of these questions are being framed from a right-wing perspective. If I ask about immigration, there's four different ways, that there's 20 different ways that I can ask about the same issue of immigration, but ask it in ways that are leading in one direction or another. And certainly, if it's up to me, I'm going to lead in a way that is framed by the left. And I imagine if Sean Hannity is doing it, he's going to lead by a frame of the right. But when you're doing a debate with Democrats, what is the point? It's for Democrats to figure out who they want to vote for. What is the point for boxing them in on a Republican frame, unless you are already taking this this primary to the general election as a reporter? Because they don't do it on the right. I mean, it's just simply they don't. And we'll see it, whether it's in the questions of abortion or the question of I mean, we won't see these debates this time around, but we've seen it in the past. So here's Bernie Sanders making. He's not broadly attacking the media. He is specifically criticizing the type of coverage he's getting and the nature of the coverage, which reporters, which politicians, like I say, there was multiple people who said this, who made these comments during the debates. But here he is, and he ties Bezos into this. But listen carefully, because he's being accused of creating some type of conspiracy, as if Jeff Bezos calls up people in the office and says, you know, don't do this.
Anybody here know how much Amazon paid in taxes last year? Yeah. See, and I talk about that all of the time. And then I wonder why the Washington Post, which is owned by Jeff Bezos, who owns Amazon, doesn't write particularly good articles about me. I don't know why.
We have pointed out over and over again that Amazon made $10 billion in profit last year. You know how much they paid in taxes? You got it. Zero. Any wonder why the Washington Post is not one of my great supporters? I wonder why. New York Times, not much better.
Now, so that's basically the evidence that Bernie Sanders is peddling some type of conspiracy theory. Here is a coverage of that on with Brian Williams. Was this last night? Okay.
This was bad.
And he's got two reporters on. One is Costa from the Washington Post. And the other one, the other one is the Wall Street Journal reporter. Here is Brian Williams.
Caught my attention from the political Twitter site called the Horse Whisperer.
Oh, pause it. Okay, he's going to start with a tweet from the political Twitter site of the Horse Whisperer.
Yeah. Prominent.
Yeah. But
prominent website, twitter.com/horsewhisperer.
This is the
high
Horse Whisperer
ranking
tweet, right?
My attention from the political Twitter site called the Horse Whisperer. Okay, since this is trending, here's my Bernie story. The year was 2016 and Bernie was already long eliminated from contention. An actual Democrat would have stopped torpedoing the nominee and worked to defeat Trump, but Bernie had books to sell. The end. That kind of nicely sums up how some Democrats feel about Bernie when they hear
Pause
him
it.
Using a...
All right, let's just stop there for a moment. So that summarizes how some Democrats perceive what Bernie did. And that is accurate. Some Democrats do perceive Bernie as having done that. Who are those Democrats? Well, since Brian Williams used the horse whisperer to represent them, let's look and see who the horse whisperer is. Turns out the horse whisperer is a marketing guy who has worked with Exxon, Aetna, Citibank. Click on the right there. This is a list of his LinkedIn. He is a senior strategy consultant, independent, consultant to leading agencies and clients. Clients include American Express, Gillette, DirecTV, L'Oreal, Exxon, Genentech, Merck, Eli Lilly. Those are pharmaceutical companies. Cisco, Verizon, AT&T, T-Mobile, Old Navy, Time, Inc., etc.
So he's definitely a Hillary Clinton Democrat.
Well, I don't know if he's a Hillary Clinton Democrat or not. The point is, he is a corporate. He is from the corporate sector. Now, led the growth efforts for U.S. offices of the International Integrated Agency Network. In this role, was responsible for cultivating relationships, proposing marketing strategies and programs for major marketers, including Aetna, Citibank, Bristol-Myers, numerous others. Now, I'm not suggesting that Aetna or Citibank or Exxon or any other of these major corporations told the horse whisperer to tweet like that. Okay? Because this dynamic and this relationship is really important. I don't believe that Aetna, AT&T, Exxon, Bristol-Myers, Eli Lilly, whatever other drug companies he worked for, you know, the ones he's not mentioning because he thinks those might be problematic.
The rumor is the military. That's whatever. A rumor I've heard. Yeah.
I'm not suggesting that any of those companies told him to tweet that.
No.
What I am suggesting is that the reason why they hire a guy like that is because he's a guy who would tweet like that. And this is an important dynamic to keep in mind here. Let's continue with that.
Trump talking point. What is the state of the Sanders campaign as you know it?
Well, the Sanders campaign is very frustrated right now with coverage, and they're not alone. Democrats, mm-hmm. Republicans, politicians generally start to blame the media when they don't like coverage. What is new and what is sort of a Trump-like attack line is tying the Washington Post to Amazon with no, you know, he has no evidence here. And we saw him tone this down a little bit, but we saw Marty Baron come back and say this is a conspiracy theory. But the Bernie Sanders campaign right now, he is pulling in second or third. He's doing a lot better than 21, 22 people in that field. But he is not moving up. He's been sort of stagnant. And so he needs to expand his support. And he is frustrated about coverage that points out that he is not, you know, he's number two, but Joe Biden is still certainly in the lead. And he is competing with people like Elizabeth Warren, who has a lot of very similar ideas, but her polling is going upwards. So while Sanders is stagnant, his campaign is frustrated by coverage that they view is not talking about all of the great things he's doing and all of the support he has, which he certainly does have support. He's got lots of donors. He's got grassroots support. But political campaigns want to talk about the good and not any of the bad.
So, Robert Costa, when General Electric owned this building and this network, it coincided with the birth of the interwebs. And a lot of conspiracy theorists had us all on a conference call every morning with Jack Welch. So we'd have the talking points from the electric power division, the nuclear division, electric trains, all of that. Of course, it was never true. And I ask you just to show our homework. When was the last time you met or heard from Jeff Bezos about your coverage?
Pause it. Now, I will tell you this, that in 2004, I knew an MSNBC contributor who was very, very explicit. We couldn't talk about it at the time, but Bob Wright, who was the NBC executive, CEO, And then the chairman and CEO until about 2007, Bob Wright spoke to Jack Welch. And Bob Wright spoke to all the people at GE who were the number one manufacturer, weapons manufacturer in this country, who owned over 51% of NBC. And I know for a fact that in the run-up to the war, they certainly got calls about people saying certain things on the network and putting Frank Luntz out there to do stuff. So Brian Williams might be right that Jack Welch never called him. But why would Jack Welch call Brian Williams? Why wouldn't Jack Welch call Brian Williams' boss and say, hey, now, my bet is that never had to happen. Because in the same way that Aetna and Exxon and Eli Lilly don't have to tell the guy who works for them and does marketing, hey, you should be critical of the political candidate who wants to take away our power. You don't have to say that to him because the reason why you hired him was because you don't have to say that to him. So when Bernie Sanders says that the Washington Post comes after him and cites the relationship they have with Amazon and the one of the richest individuals in the country with a corporation that pays no taxes, the issue isn't that Jeff Bezos calls up the Washington Post and says, hey, I need you guys to toe my line. When Jeff Bezos buys the Washington Post, he does so because it's a paper that toes his line. That doesn't mean every reporter there. But when decisions are made, and we know how it went down at the Times, when decisions are made to put coverage on Bernie Sanders, and when decisions are made to ask questions of the stable of people who are there, the least sympathetic are appointed, which does not happen. Does not happen on across the board with candidates. Look, this is controversial in the context of book reviews. And people are able to say, hey, wait a second. Why are you having someone who doesn't know anything about this topic review that book? Or why are you having someone who has a problem because his wife left him to go with this guy's brother, you know, review this book? That happens all the time. When people talk about that, there's no conspiracy theories. People say this is a bad editorial assessment. Jeff Bezos buys this paper, and if he doesn't feel like he has to interfere, it's because he's happy with what it's doing for him and his interests.
I would just like to add, I think, another thing, and I'm not sure we have time to play this Chomsky clip, but it really speaks to it, that another thing that's very reflective, and I could speak in personal conversations with some journalists, but actually also people who do marketing jobs, like the Horse Whisperer gentleman, that they are so into this unacknowledged ideology that they actually have they're being very sincere that they think that Bernie's being conspiratorial because they're so deep in that thought process that they think that any even noting of it is conspiracy, if that makes sense. Like right. they can't they're not even disingenuously putting it off. They cannot even understand the distinction between
how stupid
the
do they
water,
think Jeff Bezos is?
Bloated
literally,
like,
how stupid
the water,
how stupid would Jeff
right.
Bezos have to be to financially support a major publication that would be critical of it, of his interests.
And they understand that in every other field of life because it's intuitive and obvious. But when it comes to them, they're so regimented that they don't think so.
Hey, all right, we're going to get second? To let's do the Chomsky clip in a second. But I got to just I got to take a break. I mean, because Liquid IV has told me to say all of this. Staying properly hydrated, one of the most important factors during hot summer months. Liquid IV, the fastest, most efficient way to stay hydrated. We fight for it. We still have some in that box up there. I'm surprised. I got Mila will take some Liquid IV. I've got her doing some exercise over the course of the summer. That's been nice. I have friends who do it. I always take a bunch of packs with me when I travel. And when occasionally I go a little overboard with the celebrations, We love our Liquid IV around here. It's the fastest growing wellness brand, and it can provide the same hydration as drinking 2 to 3 bottles of water. Plus, it contains 5 essential vitamin C, more than an orange, and more potassium, or as much potassium as a banana. It's a healthy alternative to traditional sugary sports drinks. No artificial flavors, no preservatives, and it's perfect for fueling tough workouts, preventing muscle fatigue, promoting healthy post-workout recovery. You can find them everywhere. Their hydration multiplier is even sold at Costco's nationwide. I love Liquid IV. I know you will too. Right now, my listeners get 25% off at liquidiv.com when you use my code MAJORITY at checkout. That's 25% off anything you order at Liquid IV's website. Go to liquidiv.com, enter my promo code MAJORITY, get your savings, start getting better hydration. That's liquidiv.com, promo code MAJORITY. Don't wait. Start properly hydrating today. And also, in this golden age of television and podcasts, we all know the value of a truly compelling narrative. Q, Hunt a Killer. It's the murder mystery box that immerses you in an ongoing experience. With every delivery or episode, you dive deeper into what it's like being a detective. So they send you a box. And in it, it has like, it has documents, has evidence. You're going over it. It's like, what was that? True Crime? What was that one on HBO? It's like one of those
True Detective.
True Detective.
What was that? True Crime?
And
HBO?
Here's the thing I really like about it and why I got Myla into it so much. No screens. You build an investigation board. You can do it on an online community if you want. We do not. We do it at home, which is great. And we help each other through each challenge. Part of the proceeds of every box go to the Cold Case Foundation to help fund cold case investigations. For me, the thing I like it is like I liked Clue when I was a kid. And this is like uber Clue. And it's ongoing, and it's the only time that Myla will talk to me for the most part. And right now, for our listeners, my daughter, you can go to huntakiller.com/majority, get 20% off your first box. They only accept 200 members per day, so hurry to take advantage of this offer. That's huntakiller.com/majority for 20% off your first box, huntakiller.com/majority. All right, so let's continue on. I just want to play this Noam Chomsky clip, because when we talk about Bernie Sanders saying that the people who work for Jeff Bezos, unsurprisingly, have a tainted perspective to his politics. They necessarily, I mean, despite the fact that if you look at his platform, issue by issue, his policies are mainstream as far as the American public is concerned. They are, by any definition of the word, at least in terms of what they hold and support, his policies are mainstream. He is not covered in that way. And his policies are not covered in that way. And these are the type of people who are going to work in this type of institution, largely speaking. Not all, but many. That is going to be the editorial thrust. On some level, is going to be broadly status quo. This is a Washington Post has a culture and a pedigree that comes from things like saying that like Bill Clinton is not of this place. I mean, that is the attitude and culture that comes from that paper. The New York Times, no better. In some instances, I think maybe even worse. But here's Noam Chomsky talking about this dynamic.
King.
You don't wait. Like the reason, the problem that people had in my, the
with
problem
an offended
I had,
Andrew Marr, I might
the,
say.
The problem I had with Hillary Clinton doing those speeches for whatever it was, $250,000, $400,000, whatever it was not that she was going to do something for those banks because they were giving her the money. It's that they knew that she was the type of person who does stuff for them. And that's why they give them the money.
Yeah, they're friends.
Yeah, that's basically it. We are here, right here, you and I, like this. And so I don't need to tell you to do anything. I just know you're going to do it.
Sponsoring organization. Tell me how that works. Is that, you're not suggesting that proprietors phone one another up, or that many journalists get their copies spiked, as we say?
It's actually, Orwell, you may recall, has an essay called Literary Censorship in England, which was supposed to be the introduction to Animal Farm, except that it never appeared, in which he points out, look, I'm writing about a totalitarian society, but in free, democratic England, it's not all that different. And then he says, unpopular ideas can be silenced without any force. And then
he gives
a two-sentence response, which is not very profound, but captures it. He says two reasons. First, the press is owned by wealthy men who have every interest in not having certain things appear. But second, the whole educational system, from the beginning on through, just gets you to understand that there are certain things you just don't say. Well, spelling these things out, that's perfectly correct. I mean, it's the first sentence is what we expand.
This is what I don't get, because it suggests that, I mean, I'm a joke, people like me are self-censoring.
No, not self-censoring. There's a filtering system that starts in kindergarten, goes all the way through, and it doesn't work 100%, but it's pretty effective. It selects for obedience and subordination. And especially, I think that...
So stroppy people won't make it to positions of influence.
There'll be behavior problems, or if you read applications to a graduate school, you see that people will tell you he's not doesn't get along too well with his colleagues. You know how to interpret those things.
I'm just interested in this because I was brought up, like a lot of people, probably post Watergate film and so on, to believe that journalism was a crusading craft and that there were a lot of disputatious, stroppy, difficult people in journalism. And I have to say, I think I know some of them.
Well, I know some of the best and best-known investigative reporters in the United States. I won't mention names, but whose attitude toward the media is much more cynical than mine. In fact, they regard the media as a sham, and they know and they consciously talk about how they try to play it like a violin. If they see a little opening, they'll try to squeeze something in that ordinarily wouldn't make it through. And it's perfectly true that I'm sure you're speaking for the majority of journalists who are trained, have it driven into their heads, that this is a crusading profession, adversarial, we stand up against power, a very self-serving view. On the other hand, in my opinion, I hate to make a value judgment, but the better journalists, and in fact the ones who are often regarded as the best journalists, have quite a different picture.
Owned.
Well, first of all, what I love about that is like he is subtweeting the guy sitting right across from him.
Before subtweeting even existed, Noam Chomsky mastered it in interview formats.
I am talking about you, just in case you were actually wondering, but I'm not going to say that. And that is, I mean, this is the reality of this. Now, with that said, Bernie Sanders didn't come. I'm quite sure that Bernie Sanders understood this dynamic before then. And so
I saw Bernie Sanders speak in college. He made precisely the same
right.
He spent most of his speech talking about media monopolies.
Here's the other part of why what we talked about earlier is BS. Because all of those journalists, right, they're making it like he's being conspiratorial and he's being Trump-like. What Bernie Sanders is doing is he's not discovering the truth of what is problematic with the media. This is political campaigning. And the other conversation that Brian Williams could have had, and we played that stuff earlier, but the other conversation that Brian Williams had, if he didn't choose Bob Costa from The Washington Post or the other reporter from The Wall Street Journal, Costas, I mean, he's a good reporter. Started out covering right-wing stuff. Let's say Brian Williams had a different MSNBC contributor on to talk about this. Let's say he had me on. My perspective wouldn't be, you know, he's frustrated about the campaign. This is coming out of frustration in the way that, like, you know, a child, when they get frustrated because you won't give them a, you know, you won't give them a, they can't watch a second episode of television or something like this. They're complaining. He's complaining. No, what I would say, like, look, this is a reality that Bernie Sanders knows to be the case. We used to talk about media concentration in this country and the power of wealthy people owning the press as being problematic. It still is, even in the era of Donald Trump, when we have more reliance on the press than we may have wanted to, you know, admit in the past. And Bernie Sanders is using this as an example of how corporate interests are aligned and how they own this network that we're talking on, the other networks that we could be talking on, and all the papers, and that we need to rebalance stuff. And from a political perspective, this is a very smart move. This is a very smart move. Like, Brian Williams and his guests are not above taking a cynical look and looking at the political value of these machinations. And that's what they do for virtually every other single candidate. But they don't do that for Bernie Sanders. They don't say, with his brand of politics, this actually makes a lot of sense.
Right.
Because it's perfectly consistent with everything he's saying. And he's saying that there is people at the 1%, let's call it, have aligned interests. They don't necessarily have to meet at Davos to plan out their year's agenda. They have aligned interests, and they work in those interests, and they have outsized power, and that's what you get. But even the way that they framed that segment was indicative of the problems. And even though Jeff Bezos doesn't work at, you know, doesn't own MSNBC, Comcast does, GE does. And they're more comfortable, and Brian Williams certainly understands this, with stuff that is a little bit more to the right than where they've been in the past.
You don't need to give Jake Tapper questions or talking points, but if we did a really easy thought experiment, if the CNN ad lineup was filled primarily with Teamsters unions and UAW ads, it's very unlikely that he would say, John Delaney, you say that Bernie's healthcare plan is going to ruin American society. Would you like to elaborate that?
I disagree with that.
Different,
I think,
well, maybe,
I think,
excuse me, maybe the question to Delaney, but the entire frame of the question would be massaged and influenced by the context.
Jake Tapper is not sensitive to what ads are on there.
No.
Jake Tapper wouldn't be hired if this was...
I'm not giving you a linear... I'm not saying linearly he watches it.
Yeah,
I'm
in the same way that it is arranged now.
Broader atmosphere, the filtering that Chomsky
talked about. I don't even think it's that sensitive. Because certainly I know that unions used to advertise on MSNBC. I don't know if they still do. But unions used to advertise on MSNBC because they thought they could aggregate the biggest audience of the left there. BP used to advertise on MSNBC because they thought they could aggregate
themselves as green.
They could aggregate the biggest group of most outspoken critics of them there. The advertising thing is ebbs and flows. The bottom line is these are owned by major corporations. They will hire people who are corporate friendly. Period. End of story. There is no specific pressure that comes in these in these news organizations. But the general flow of things is what leads you down these certain paths. What you get rewarded with leads you down these paths. And they're not even specific. It's not if you do this, you'll get that. It's just broad principles that you see. And you see them more, and that's how you got through the door in the first place.
Yep. I co-sign everything that you said. Can I just add two things real quick?
Please.
I agree with Chad Vigorous, or Pretty Bad Lefty's take on Twitter, which is that Bernie stands to pick up more votes from Joe Rogan fans and Cardi B fans than he does from people who stan MSNBC. So maybe this won't be so bad for him. And two, can we just appreciate the terminally basic mean girl shade on display in that first clip. Like, you are only talking about me for attention because your campaign is crashing and burning. Sad. Like, if anyone is using a Trumpian line, I think it's that.
Right. I think that's true. And frankly, I think that on balance, I'm not quite sure that even the MSNBC discussion doesn't help Bernie. I mean, to the extent that there were people out there who do have issues with corporate control who watch MSNBC, there's some. I think it also raises his, you know, him out there. I don't think this in its totality actually hurts Bernie at all. I think Bernie wants to be in the news, and I don't think it necessarily hurts Bernie to be criticized by Brian Williams or by someone from the Wall Street Journal. In fact, like, let's recall what the sort of one of the biggest, you know, sort of like piercing things that pierced through the noise in terms of Bernie's ad campaigns was, here are the people who don't endorse me. And having them all line up to not endorse him and to criticize him, I think, is probably not a bad thing. It's just people should be aware of what the dynamics are and how this works, because there's more to be gleaned from this than just how it impacts Bernie Sanders. I mean, we should be watching the news always with this perspective and this understanding. These are broad, they're very sort of like long, broad strokes in terms of what impacts the media in this way. And so let's talk about this. These new regulations by the Trump administration. They're basically a way of limiting immigration, particularly legal immigration for people who are already here as well. This public charge stuff. And, I mean, it fails under the weight of its own rules anyways. But here is Aaron Burnett in the ongoing saga of Ken Cuccinelli trying to make the Trump policy fit in to, at the very least, the perception we have about ourselves in this country. That perception, I would say, is probably a little bit more aspirational than actual, but nevertheless, let's use this frame when it is worthwhile. And to a certain extent, there is an obvious truth to the fact that it wasn't necessarily always with open arms, and it wasn't always necessarily pleasant. But this country was built and has been built through much of its history on taking in refugees and immigrants from around the world. And it has strengthened this society in many respects. Here's Aaron Burnett, again, returning to Ken Cuccinelli's, you'll recall yesterday we played this clip when he was asked about, we'll take in your poor, your wretched. And then he said, and he added, we will take in your poor and your wretched who can stand up on their own 2 feet and blah, blah, blah. Now, that concept is good for Ken Cuccinelli. We'll pick it up after this.
You say this is about self-sufficiency, and you say that proudly. You heard me play you this morning when you quoted the Emma Lazarus poem on the Statue of Liberty.
Oh, I wasn't quoting it. I was answering a question.
Right. Okay. I'm sorry. But you were giving your version of what you thought the poem should say, right?
No. No, I was not.
You said, give me your tired and your poor who can stand on.
I'm not rewriting poetry.
Okay. Well, what you said is, give me your tired and your poor who can stand on their own 2 feet and who will not become a public charge. I just played you saying it.
Right. I listened.
Okay. So I'm just making sure you're not disputing what you said. Okay. So obviously the actual poem is quite different. I'm going to read it.
Right. I was answering a question. I wasn't writing poetry, Aaron. Don't change the facts.
I'm not changing the facts. I'm just saying.
You're twisting this like everybody else on the left has done all day today.
No, because I think it's important. You're saying that it's very important to be able to stand on your own 2 feet. A lot of people may support you and respect your saying that. But the poem doesn't say that. right? The poem that's on the Statue of Liberty.
I didn't bring up the poem. Well, an NPR reporter did, and now you have. Okay, I didn't bring it up. I'll answer your substantive intelligence
questions.
So
I'm going to give you a substantive intelligence. Okay. However it came up, you said, give me your tired and your poor. Okay? Who can stand on their own 2 feet and who will not become a public charge. That's what you said. I just played it. The poem reads, give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free, the wretched refuse of the teeming shore. Send these, the homeless, tempest-tossed to me. I lift my lamp beside the golden door. Wretched, poor refuse, right? That's what the poem says America's supposed to stand for. So what do you think America stands for?
Well, of course, that poem was referring back to people coming from Europe where they had class-based societies, where people were considered wretched if they weren't in the right class. And it was introduced, it was written one year.
Now, what the F is this guy talking about?
Yeah, America was a total communist egalitarian utopia.
But wait
a second.
I get it. What's his logic?
His logic is that, yes, in the way he's talking about class is that in a European context at that time, you might even be relatively loaded, but you're looked down upon because you don't have a title or something. And so you can come here and you don't have to put on airs, but you have a lot of money still, so you can stand on your own 2 feet.
So class is identity.
I think it's literally, I think it's basically what he's saying. You don't know the difference between
poor?
Like, idea. I'm not saying he's, I'm telling you how I think he's spinning it, dude.
I think he's
just skipping over poor. I think this is like, he should rewrite the Bible, like the meek who own their own businesses shall inherit the earth.
The
small business.
The meek small business owner.
I mean, Aaron may have emphasized wretched, but the poor seems to be the operative issue here.
I think he's not talking. I think he's poor of title.
Poor of title.
There's a lot of old Regency dramas about that type of thing. This guy's he's got a shoe factory.
I'm sure
he wants to marry the Duchess. Everything's fine, but it's a problem because he ain't a duke.
Poor of Olive Gardens.
It was written one year after the first federal public charge rule was written that says, and I'll quote it, any person unable to take care of himself without becoming a public charge, unquote, would be inadmissible, or in the terms that my agency deals with, they can't do what's called adjusting status, getting a green card, becoming legal permanent residents. Same exact time, Aaron, same exact time. In the year it went on the Statue of Liberty, 1903, another federal law was passed expanding the elements of public charge by Congress. This is a.
I mean, when my family came here, they came here as crofters from Scotland, right? They had no education. They had nothing.
Right.
But I am here because they were allowed in. And I'm an anchor on CNN.
Right.
So I'm just saying I wouldn't be here.
My Italian grandfather sponsored his two cousins to come here. This is a tradition that many of our families, yours and mine, can point to. Yeah.
Right.
This is
but not Aaron, we're white. We're white from Europe. Well, we weren't at the time, but we are now.
Exclusionary.
But what I'm saying is I would have been excluded. I don't know about you, but I would have been.
Well, no, that's not. You're deciding on one point. And our ISOs are going to take what's called a totality of the circumstances test, which has long been the test for public charge.
OK.
And this.
He's lying about this. And I'll tell you this. Here's the thing. The public charge thing is a vague term. And the rules and regulations that define it. And according to this new rules and regulation, they must have a 51%. They must assess with each potential immigrant. They must assess that there's a 51% chance that they will end up being a public charge. Now, we know that at least 80% of all immigrants do not become a public charge. And there is no subset of that group that has any different numbers than that. You can't say only 50% of immigrants from Guatemala don't become public charges. Or only 40% of people from
Moldova,
whatever,
Moldova.
Don't become public charges. There is no Department of Homeland Statistics that would indicate that you can make an assessment on any group of immigrants that they're going to be a public charge. 51% sure. So this is ripe for abuse, and it's intimidating immigrants, and it's total BS.
Well, he's not lying about the law from 1882, though. Like, it's crazy. It's funny because I had it pulled up before he even brought it up. I pulled it up at the beginning of this segment.
No,
like,
I have the law here in front of me as well.
He's giving evidence that that the Statue of Liberty has been lying since the beginning.
No, he's not, because the public charge rule had to do with a lot of different stuff at that time than what he's made it out to be. You could obviously get in if you were poor. The question is, do you have someone who is going to vouch for you?
Seems like,
well,
the
that's
same
my point is
idea.
They've changed. It's not the same idea. It is the same idea, but in practice, it's radically different. That's the whole point why they've changed the rule, the public charge rule.
Well, I'll also add that the criminal provision of the act did not include immigrants who were convicted of political offenses, reflecting the traditional American belief that the United States is a haven for those persecuted by foreign tyrants. And that's definitely not being honored now.
Right. All right. Let's go to the phones. Yeah. You got a phone up? Call him from a 509 area code. Who's this? 509.
Hey. Hello.
Hello. Is this Ronald Reagan?
Is this me?
Yes.
Yeah. Hey.
Ronald Reagan.
Tell
us about this public charge thing.
Cuomo?
Huh?
Oh. Oh, you want to talk about immigration? Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I have. Okay. Yeah, that's fine. So for public charge, it might help just real quick to talk about the way that it already exists. So if I have a client, he's a foreign national, let's just say he's Mexican, and he's been here for 20 years working and supporting himself and without access to the social safety net. And he gets married to a U.S. citizen. She wants to petition for him. She has to also file this affidavit of support, this contract with the government. But if she's a stay-at-home mom, even though he's been completely self-sufficient for many years in this country, his income doesn't count towards the affidavit of support because it doesn't technically come from a legal source since he's working without permission. So anyhow, this person who's been totally self-sufficient has to go and find a co-sponsor, usually a family member, maybe a boss, and ask them to sign off on the same sort of contract that they'll support this person.
Yeah, and let's just be clear here. I just want to be clear here, and you gotta talk a little more clearly because there's something going on with your phone that sounds a little weird. But this affidavit is a contract where you're basically, it's almost like you're guaranteeing an apartment for somebody, right? It's like if they don't pay the rent, I will pay the rent.
Right. Except, but not for bills and things like that, but for any type of means tested benefits. And so that's an obstacle for a lot of people, even though, like I said, they've already been working. They're very self-sufficient, and the new rule is like 800 pages long, but there's some pretty nefarious stuff in there. Like they can look at English language skills to determine whether or not the person could be self-sufficient. That's never been a requirement. Obviously they can do credit score, credit check, and more things like that. But overall, it's just creating a sense of fear. It doesn't apply to a lot of types of immigrants, like asylees or refugees, but even those people have been taking their kids off of, Medicaid or Obamacare, thinking that they're going to be rounded up and deported if they get food stamps, for example, for their U.S. citizen children. But one of the things that I think is not really being reported, which is pretty nefarious about all of this, is that USCIS, which is a benefits agency, it's not ICE, it's not Border Patrol.
Ron Reagan, wait, hold on for a second. What are you talking into?
Yeah.
What are you talking into? Are you talking into a phone? Like, are you talking to a headset?
Yeah.
Headset? Oh, that's better. Whatever you just did, right? That's much better.
Okay.
Yeah, much better.
Okay. I turned off my Prius.
Great.
I'm gonna die in the sun.
I can't hear too
good. It's all worth it.
I don't know.
So, USCIS has made two other changes. One is that if you file for a green card, they can essentially deny the case. Typically, they'll issue a request for evidence if they're unsatisfied with the evidence that you filed or that you submitted. But they announced this change, I don't know, maybe a year ago or so, saying, if we're unsatisfied, rather than issue a request for evidence, we can just flat deny the case. And so you're then out the $1,200 filing fee if you filed for a green card. So that's one change. And the other change is that they're going to be more aggressive in issuing notices to appear to removal proceedings for cases that they deny. So if you take a situation where now, instead of just looking at an affidavit of support, and does somebody support you who earns enough money, yes or no, well, now we're going to look at all of these other circumstances, like what kind of diseases you might have, or if you speak enough English, all of these other things. And we're going to use that as a pretext to deny your application. And we're going to be more aggressive in denying applications and in forwarding your case to the Immigration Court for deportation proceedings. It has a real chilling effect, and also could result in, you know, lots of good people being denied and tied up in hearings for years and years. So this guy's a real douchebag, Ken Cuccinelli, with all due respect. But it's not just the affidavit of support and the public charge thing, although I think that's horrible. But it's the sort of combination of three or four different policies, which make it possible to really target people and turn what's supposed to be a benefits agency into an enforcement agency.
Right.
And there's also a lot of other types of cases where people have to go back to their country to consular process. And that's, you know, they've emboldened the consular officers to deny more cases on the affidavit of support and on the public charge grounds. And the problem with that is that if you go to consular process in Mexico, let's say, and if they deny the affidavit of support, now instead of being in Mexico for a couple of weeks, the process can really drag on. You could be down there for 3 or 4 months. And for a lot of people, that's not an option. And so, you know, more and more people are going to just stop applying for things that they perfectly qualify for.
And do you know about the 1882 law? The public charge
wait a second. Wait. Let me just... We can get to the 1882 law in a second. So what, when you say that people are applying for benefits, what benefits are they eligible for now? I mean, based on their status?
Well, usually people aren't applying for benefits for themselves. It's for their U.S. citizen children,
right?
Which is perfectly fine. So food stamps or things like that. Under the current rules, Medicaid and Obamacare, those sorts of things are okay. Mostly it's, you know, TANF and certain things like that they're not, supposed to be getting, or, I think like certain types of emergency medical, treatment, could be included. The affidavit of support typically is used, it's not enforced all that much by the government, but it can be used in the family court context in a divorce. So when Michael brings over his wife from wherever, Moldova.
Oh, right, there you go.
And
it's amazing you'd want to make that joke, Ral Reagan.
Yeah, his wife, And then he's like, you know, he kicks her to the curb because it's Michael, right? She could use the affidavit of support in their divorce proceedings to say, look, this guy promised to provide for me. And that's typically how it's enforced. But
so wait, so
you know, it is also enforceable by the government.
Are there situations where someone is in here, they have no papers, that they're getting TANF support?
No.
No. Right?
No.
Are there instances no.
right.
where people are in here without papers and they're getting food stamps?
No.
So what we're
no.
talking about is we're talking yeah. about people who have a legal status, but they're en route to trying to become citizens because their kids are citizens, or they're getting married to a citizen, or their parents are citizens, maybe theoretically, I guess. And they're simply
right.
And so they have some type of residency status here. They have some type of visa. They're legal.
Right. Well, so it's people who are either so they're not applying for citizenship. They're applying for permanent residency or a green
right.
card. So they're either going from undocumented or what they call a non-immigrant visa, so like a student visa or a temporary visa, to being allowed to stay here permanently with a green card. So it's in that process that, you know, they look at all kinds of grounds of inadmissibility or reasons to deny your green card. It could be terrorism grounds or immigration, negative immigration history. There's a big long list of things that can disqualify you, and public charge is one, and it has been one for a long time. Basically, since like 1997, they've said, just fill out this form, prove that you earn 150% of the poverty guidelines based on your household size, and that's sufficient to not be denied a green card because of on public charge grounds. And now what they're saying is, well, we don't want to just look at how much you're making or how much your sponsor is making. We want to be able to pull back the curtain and look at all of these other things. And, you know, let's run a credit score of you or your wife or your co-sponsor, or let's, you know, take a look at how much English you're speaking and these sorts of things. So,
they're raising the bar, essentially, is what they're doing, and they're looking for any type of excuse to deny people. All right, so Jamie had a question about the original underlying law of the public charge that Cuccinelli was talking
yeah,
about.
Yeah, like reading through the language in this law, I don't see how what's happening now is not a legacy of immigration policy that we've had for a very long time.
Right. Yeah, I think that's true. And in a way, like when Cuccinelli's like, hey, well, the Statue of Liberty, we meant Europeans, like he's telling a more accurate version of history than people who are like, this isn't who we are and we're better than this. It's like, no, we're not. And his version of the history and of our immigration history specifically is actually pretty accurate. And that's the problem, right? So, like, getting lost in some poem rather than talking about the realities of our policies over the last 100-plus years seems like a real failure on the part of the media.
How was the charge law, though, used? I mean, 97, obviously, it was amended. What was it prior to that?
I don't know too much about that. I was in like middle school, so.
Well, you knew about 97.
No, I mean, I'm not sure exactly. You know, I think it's been pretty much the same for quite a while. But I'm not sure if it was more strictly enforced or less strictly enforced. I'm sure it's sort of ebbed and flowed
right
to some degree, but I don't know specifically.
All right, well, thanks
but,
for
yeah, I mean, it's this guy's a real piece of work, and he's terrible. I did want to ask you real quick about Chris Cuomo.
Yeah.
Don't you think it was kind of lame that he stepped to this guy and threatened to push him down a flight of stairs? That's like stepping to somebody and threatening to push him in front of a bus, kind of, right? Like, I think you're either going to fight a guy or you're not, but don't, like, use a flight of stairs to win the fight for you. To me, that was the most offensive part of the whole thing.
Yeah, I mean, Ronald Reagan, I mean, that's looking like a guy who really clearly never gotten in any type of, like, altercation with another guy. That's his way of saying, like, I'm going to beat you up, and then I can do with you whatever I want, like, i.e., throw you down the stairs. That was, like, what that guy said to that guy, the former Staten Island congressman, when he's like, I'm going to throw you over the edge here in this rotunda.
Like a boy.
Yeah. It's.
I wish. I
don't think he was being literal.
I don't think he was being literal.
I think what Cuomo was actually saying was like, I'm going to threaten you until one of my posse comes here and gets in between us so that we don't actually have to have a fight because I know I'm going to get sued.
I thought it was funny how he said, I'll throw you down the stairs and I'm smart. Not like everybody says.
We're going to play that clip in a bit. But first, we have to go to the fun half. Folks. You can become a member of this program by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. Jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you not only support the free show, you get extra content every day. Jointhemajorityreport.com. Check it out. Don't forget, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. And check out the AM Quickie. It's going to be here. Particularly during the week that we're on vacation, or still, I should say, it's in the audio feed of the Majority Report. You got to sign up for the audio feed. You can do that through your podcast app or the free version, and it'll be living in there. Oh, and happy birthday, belated to Michael Brooks, who made it back just
much
in time for his party and TMBS.
Well, indeed.
I mean, supposedly made it back just in time.
Supposedly.
We all know that you landed on Sunday, but that's all right.
I was supposed to land on Monday, so get your facts straight. And no.
You were supposed to land on Monday.
I was going to always
miss Monday.
And then you ended
up landing on
Tuesday. I'm still going to miss Monday regardless.
Right.
Just
to be
clear about that.
No.
Tuesday was what was in question. Monday
right.
was never happening.
Right.
Yes. But
so you
what a shame
landed.
That I missed your charming self.
I'm sure
birthday.
That you were not in town on Tuesday.
I was not in town Tuesday.
There's a lot of knots there.
Take from that what you will. But before we go to my story, post-roll, I believe.
Well, yeah, I'm going to do the post-roll.
Oh, okay. All right. I thought you did those first. All right. Last night, we talked with Elaine Yu. She's an AFP reporter based in Hong Kong about the uprising there, but also some of the sort of broader Chinese political questions and even sort of correlations with what's happening in Kashmir. Brianna Joy Gray, TMBS crew for life. She's also Bernie Sanders' press secretary. We had a very big conversation about media bias, what the Sanders campaign is doing, and that sort of thing. And in the post game, we all went over our Jeffrey Epstein theories and talked about Argentina, South Asia, a whole bunch more. I just want to say briefly, for one group of patrons, we release now video illicit histories, which are very, very well produced mini documentaries. And usually, and after a month where they're just for the patrons at a $21 and above level, we release them on YouTube. And so I would like everybody to check out the one we just put on YouTube of Patrice Lumumba and the Congo versus imperialism, featuring Milton Alamadi. I'm incredibly proud of these. And the next one we'll be doing on a history of Brazil going back to the 60s. Patreon.com/TMBS.
Jamie, you were in country yesterday.
I was indeed. So this week on the Antifada, we had actress, comedian, and DSA organizer Simone Norman on. You may know her from the hilarious video that was going around when hot mean girls decide to become public leftists. Everything is praxis. She joined us for a little chat. We talked about the DSA convention in Atlanta. We talked about some of the resolutions that got passed, like the one on open borders. I took another stab at talking about borders for anyone who was curious/confused by the stuff I was saying the other day. on, you know, the long-term prospects of the social democratic welfare state, borders, ego-fascism, yada, yada. We talked about sex work decriminalization, the Bernie or bust resolution, also the close the camps, nonviolent direct action that I was a part of, white supremacist violence and its connections to capitalism, and the uses and abuses of irony. And we also have a bonus with Simone coming out on Friday in which we talk about the video.
Brendan, you do not have a podcast, but Matt.
Just only adding for Sam's profound love for you, Brendan.
Yeah, but
you don't have some damn project that you have to promote.
Right.
I love you, Brendan. Thank you for my sound clips.
But Matt does.
Literary Hangover, check it out.
Thank you.
George Orwell, history infused with ganja.
That's just for patrons.
Check it out.
Folks, Hunt to Killer is the murder mystery box that immerses you in an ongoing experience. With every delivery or episode, you'll dive deeper into what it's like to be a detective, sifting through piles of documents, evidence, case files until you crack the case. Probably bad coffee. You're going to have to make that yourself. Right now, just for our listeners, you can go to huntakiller.com/majority for 20% off your first box. They only accept 200 members per day, so hurry to take advantage of this offer. That's huntakiller.com/majority for 20% off your first box. huntakiller.com/majority. Quick break, fun half, 646-257-3920. Left is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2. 5/8. 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Rand Paul.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabber.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good. Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.